hppodcraft.com.
As an intern in the Terrestrial Hospital at Ignarth, I had charge of the singular case of Rodney Severn, the one surviving member of the Octave expedition to Yovambis, and took down the following story from his dictation. Severn had been brought to the hospital by the Martian guides of the expedition. He was suffering from a horribly lacerated and inflamed condition of the scalp and brow, and was wildly delirious part of the time and had to be held down in his bed during recurring seizures of a mania whose violence was doubly inexplicable in view of his extreme debility. The lacerations, as will be learned from the story, were mainly self-inflicted. They were mingled with numerous small round wounds, easily distinguished from the knife slashes and arranged in regular circles through which an unknown poison had been injected into Severn's scalp. The causation of these wounds was difficult to explain, unless one were to believe that Severn's story was true and was no mere figment of his illness. Speaking for myself in the light of what afterwards occurred, I feel that I have no other recourse than to believe it. There are strange things on the Red Planet, and I can only second the wish that was expressed by the doomed archaeologist in regard to future explorations.
My good friend and excellent Chicago artist George Eckhart once said of a movie he didn't like, "Don't go see it. Don't even go see it." Which is what this space doctor is saying to all of us about Yovambis, the Martian MTV hip-hop show at the core of this Clark Ashton Smith story. This was recommended by many folks, including Brian Pitt, who wrote CAS's Mars Stories. Really are great. I recommend The Vaults of Yovambis. And he's right.
There you go.
We're here to talk about it. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. Is Yovambis the space version of Yo MTV Raps?
Yeah, I mean, that's what any normal person would assume from the title. But actually, it turns out it's about an ancient Martian civilization. Alan Ricks, under Brian's comment on our show, wrote, seconded the recommendation. It's one of my favorite stories altogether and definitely my favorite CAS story. Exploring an ancient Martian ruined city long dead and coming across the mummified remains of its inhabitants only to awaken what did them in is nirvana. The cloakers from AD&D and the entire Alien franchise are totally indebted to this story. And first of all, I started college in 1992, so I can understand being done in by Nirvana. And second of all, I always wondered this. Why is it advanced D&D?
What's different about advanced D&D than just regular D&D? You get more options. Now, when D&D first came out, you would be like a warrior, a magic user, an elf, or a dwarf. But in advanced Dungeons & Dragons, you could be like a dwarf wizard or an elf fighter. You know, there's just more complicated rules, more options.
That makes sense. I guess I just thought it was like extra strength Tylenol. I always think, well, why don't you just take more Tylenol? You know, aren't you the people that are advanced? I mean, any Dungeons & Dragons I play is advanced Dungeons & Dragons. That's how I feel.
Alan mentioned the cloakers from AD&D.
Yeah.
Last week, we had the Displacer Beast, but the creature from this also reminds me of Operation Annihilate from the original series of Star Trek, those things that were flying around and landed on Spock's back.
Oh, yeah, the novelty vomit creatures.
Yeah.
novelty pool of vomit. But that episode really skeeved me out when I was a kid. I kind of can still remember the day I saw it, you know, the chips I was eating, where I was, everything, because it made me feel a little sick, but I couldn't stop watching. That one in particular was a really creepy Star Trek.
It scared me as a kid. It really scared. That one scared me. The salt vampire scared me, which I think we talked about last week.
Yeah, we just talked about that recently, And, you know, the one with Abraham Lincoln in space was horrifying. Horrifying. Hey, speaking of AD&D, the most advanced D&D player also plays it through music in your minds. Daily. And that's a member of Loot the Body, who's our reader today.
Yeah, Levi Nunez is rocking Loot the Body. There is a new album from Loot the Body, the Barrier Peak Songbook. Check it out. It's got all the good stuff. We're Veggie Pygmies, Robot Police, The Doctor, Layers of Your Mind. It's so good. There's just so much great, psychedelic, beautiful, amazing stuff.
Tom York, actually, I heard, listened to Robot Police and just retired. He was like,
yeah,
it's done. Radiohead's over. Nobody can do better than this.
Nope, that was it.
Nobody does it better. I don't know if you've heard Tom York do that cover, but it's actually about Levi. But thanks for reading, Levi. Always great to have him. Let's get into the story.
Yeah, well, it was first published in 1931 in Weird Tales. This is one of the four Clark Ashton Smith Mars stories. The others are Dweller in the Gulf, Volthoom, and Seedling of Mars / the Planet Entity. There's also a fragment called Nemoka.
It looks like there was a lot of back and forth on getting this text published. The version we're sharing in the show notes had this preface by Steve Behrens that was written in 1988, which, by the way, that's when UMTV Rap started, so that joke would have killed with Steve while he was writing this preface.
And it only ran until 1995, which blew my mind.
It wasn't on for very long, but...
not even a decade.
It's like the Beatles, man. You don't need much more time than a decade.
True.
This is what it says in this preface. The Vaults of Yovambis and the City of the Singing Flame are the two works for which Clark Ashton Smith is most famous. I didn't know that. This is that big of a story, huh? Ironically, both of these stories have suffered greatly under publication. The text of The Vaults of Yovambis was more heavily edited for publication than any other story by Smith, at the insistence of Weird Tales editor Farnsworth Wright. This present edition of The Vaults of Yovambis restores the nearly 2,000 words of atmospheric description excised by Smith, while keeping otherwise to his final thoughts for the story. Yeah, as usual, I kind of agree with Farnsworth on this story. You know, most of the description is pretty excessive. But I do also have this problem where one side of my brain is the editor. You know, go simple, be straightforward, know what idea you're presenting. That's basically my philosophy about things. But then there is that side of my brain that's like 4 hours of this new Justice League cut. It's not enough. Where's part two? You know, I want a break for lunch and come back.
God.
I just like excess. I do. There's a part of me that goes, you know what? Do more of that, whatever it is.
Oh, no.
To get back to the preface, it says, the period of original composition of The Vaults of Yovambis was late August to mid-September 1931. It seems to me that a number of elements, literary and otherwise, contributed to the story's inception and development. One distinctly non-literary source was a brush fire Smith fought 1 month earlier, which had left the sky, as Smith put it, as dark and dingy as the burnt-out sky of the planet Mars. Immediate literary sources include Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness, which Smith had read in July, and from which he surely took the idea of the floor paintings found in the catacombs. I would argue quite a bit more.
Yeah.
This is kind of At the Mountains of Space Madness.
Yeah.
I think it could have been a good title for it. To Smith's dismay, Wright demanded that he speed up the first half of the story on the plea that many of his readers would never get to the interesting portion as it stands. Hit it out of the park on that one, Farnsworth. Smith complained about this to Lovecraft in a letter. Oh, hell. I suppose I can throw out a lot of the descriptive matter, but it's a crime all the same. I wonder if some of that was performative to kind of get Lovecraft on his side, you know?
Yeah.
Lovecraft's like, I know what you mean, man. The revised Vaults of Yovambis was accepted by Weird Tales by return mail, with Wright calling it a tremendous tale, a powerful story. Just after the story's acceptance, Smith summed up the situation as a position to Lovecraft. I would have told Wright to go chase himself if I didn't have the support of my parents and debts to pay off. However, I didn't reduce the tale by as much as Wright suggested, and I refused to sacrifice the essential details and incidents of the preliminary section. What I did do mainly was to condense the descriptive matter. I don't know if he was successful at that or not, because we have the full version here. That's what we're doing. Says the original version of the vaults was given as a gift to Robert Barlow in 34. For some reason, Barlow didn't deliver it in the 50s to the Lovecraft collection at Brown University, as he did with many of his other Smith manuscripts. Instead, it made the rounds through the hands of private collectors and booksellers. As of 88, it was sold on the West Coast for $3,500. The latest episode in its long history, the text of this edition was arrived at by consulting a copy of the original manuscript and the manuscript of the published version, which forms part of the Smith collection at Brown. So that's what we read here. That's what we're linking out to. That's enough prefacing. Let's do it.
Well, this story, like so many of these stories, begins with a preface of a guy recounting a tale of someone else. This story takes place on Mars in the future.
In a space hospital, which is my favorite of all settings. If I ever do a medical show, it will be a space hospital because I don't want to learn anything.
So this guy, Octave, had an expedition to the legendary city of Yovambis. No trace of the others have been found. Just this guy, Rodney Severn. He had cuts on his face and these little sucker marks. He was treated, and physically, he's mostly all right. But last night, he ran away and nobody can find him. Now we get the narrative of Rodney Severn. There are 8 people on this expedition to Yovambis. Alan Octave is in charge, expert in Martian archaeology.
By the way, at the opening of the narrative, it says, if the doctors are correct in their prognostication, I have only a few Martian hours of life remaining to me. Which made me laugh out of the gate. Why did he say Martian hours? This isn't intended for a Martian audience, I don't think. So why does he...
It could be that Mars has a different length of day. So if you're going to break it up into chunks, it could be different hours. I'm just throwing stuff out there. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense.
I guess it's important for him to say that so you know why he goes on at length. He's like, a Martian hour is actually really long, so I'm just going to go into the description hard. By the way, 120 Martian Minutes was a huge show on Space MTV.
Oh, right, yeah.
The guy who wrote the preface would have been dying from that joke while he wrote that forward. in 1988.
So our guy Rodney is new to the group, having been a researcher on Venus. Iovampus was said to be mythical, but rumored to be not far from the human colony of Ignar. There are Martians still alive, and they are guides on this expedition. They are described as nude, spongy-chested natives.
Spongy-chested, that's so weirdly specific and yet non-specific. You know, the 40-year-old virgin, that movie, was born in a sketch that Steve Carell did at Second City where he was a 40-year-old virgin trying to describe sex to people and pretend that he knew what it was.
At the card game. It's in the movie.
Yeah. That's what spawned it. But if you see other iterations of it, because in the movie, I think he was like, oh, I felt her breasts. They were like sandbags. And they were like, what? There are a million iterations of that sketch that he did, and they're all hilarious. But spongy, you know, oh, yeah, they were like a couple of, she was real spongy chested. That sounds just like something he would have said. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
So there are constantly these really bad sandstorms to the southwest of Ignar, and that is where Octave believes the ruins to be. They push through the storm and they find the ruins just before nightfall.
There's a little time wasted letting us know that this city was closer than they thought it would be. Like, it's mentioned several times. We actually didn't have to go that far. That's one of those things where you go, why? Who cares? You could have said they got in a car. It doesn't matter at all. But it's kind of fun to see the non-edited version, because then you see what are the things that the author was getting hung up on. You know, he was probably up at night going, you know, people aren't going to buy this story if they think the because archaeologists don't like to walk very far. So I got to make sure I call attention to the fact this is very close.
So it's a big, strange, alien place, but it's tens of thousands of years old. The Urus, the Martians that built Iovampus, were killed out 40,000 years ago, but they don't know how they died. They hope this expedition will provide some answers.
It says something like they were wiped out by the present ruling race at least 40,000 years ago. So they do have this germ of an idea that it was a simple thing with an indigenous population being killed by a dominant invading force. He says there's a story, isn't there, that the last remnants of the Urus was destroyed by some unknown agency, something too horrible in outre to be mentioned even in a myth. I thought it was weird that they introduced that they were exterminated by the current race and then said, but there's also a myth about how they went away. It was clumsy, I thought. Which is it? You know, just pick one.
The Ahias, which are the Martian people, have always stayed away from this place. They set up a camp way outside the city. The Martian nights are very cold, and the temperature drops below freezing.
I mean, maybe this is it, but it's so close, yet they've never visited it. And it's because the Martian guides don't want to go there. So they're the townspeople.
Yeah.
You know, the superstitious townspeople. I was thinking about this as they were introduced, these townspeople. You know, it'd be really cool would be to do a show or a movie about the townspeople, say, in by Dracula's castle. Because by the third guy, their woman that goes up there, they kind of got to see him coming, right? So wouldn't they start running it like a racket? You know? You know what? We'll store all your stuff for you. They just really try to fleece these people before they go up to Castle Dracula, because they know they ain't coming back. Or if they do, they're going to have a serious brain fever. At what point are they going to stop warning them and start just trying to get their money? Anyway, it's like 0 degrees Martian Celsius out there, guys. Mm-hmm. They do have some inkling that maybe it was biological what wiped the race out. Uh-huh. The Urhis may have been cleaned out by some terrible epidemic. And Octave says, we needn't be afraid of getting it. If there are any mummies in Iovampus, the bacteria will be dead as their victims after so many cycles of planetary desiccation. Anyway, there ought to be a lot for us to learn. Yeah, the humility. That would be number one.
Yes.
Why? You make a lot of assumptions right out the gate.
There's something about this time period with the science fiction. The characters are really stupid in these stories. Black Destroyer, we were going nuts on how stupid those guys are. And this story, we got more stupid people. Now, Rodney has trouble sleeping. He thinks maybe from the cold, but also from the sense of dread that infuses the ruins in the distance. Now, he's lying there looking up at the ancient city, and he thinks he sees something moving towards the camp. It seemed like a roughly circular piece of cloth or leather, dark and crumpled, and 12 or 14 inches in diameter, that ran along the ground with a doubling movement of an inchworm, causing it to fold and unfold in a startling manner as it went. He loses sight of it, but then he doesn't feel too stressed out about it, because he's kind of half awake, half asleep, so he just sort of drifts off back to sleep.
That's the kind of monster I was talking about when I was asking for these. You know, it's like a furry piece of notebook paper inching around, snapping up on faces. It really creeped me out.
It's creepy. So the morning he wakes up and everyone's fine, so he doesn't really even think about what he saw last night. He doesn't bother telling anyone because he was probably just dreaming. So they go explore the ruins, but the Martian guides, they stay back. They want nothing to do with this place. They go in, it's amazing, very mountains of metal. them this strange architecture. Octave is in awe. Everybody's excited. They don't find anything of real interest at first, no markings or artifacts, but they do find stairs that go down and they think, hey, maybe most of the city is actually underground. They go down the stairs and they find this huge vault. There is all this gray dust, which might be dead fungus?
The air was singularly heavy, as if the lees of an ancient atmosphere, less tenuous than that of Mars today, had settled down and remained in that stagnant darkness. It was harder to breathe than the outer air. It was filled with unknown effluvia, and the light dust arose before us at every step, diffusing a faintness of bygone corruption like the dust of powdered mummies. Okay, these guys all die. Let's not kid around. You know, right now, they're a few seconds away from getting notebooked. But how many of these guys would have perished anyway later from mummy lung? I mean, come on. And then we get it, the scene right out of Alien. Our torch is revealed an immense shallow urn or pan supported on short cube-shaped legs and wrought from a dull blackish-green material which suggested some bizarre alloy of metal and porcelain. In the bottom of the bowl, we perceived a deposit of dark and cinder-like fragments which gave off a slight but disagreeable pungence, like the phantom of some more powerful odor. Octave, bending over the rim, began to cough and sneeze as he inhaled it. You know, I do have to say, after this last 2 years, I used to complain about things like Black Destroyer Prometheus. I'd say, who would ever do something so stupid? But the answer is everyone you know. Maybe these things aren't as unlike reality as we say they are.
Yeah, maybe.
You know?
Yeah.
Humans are pretty dumb.
Humans are pretty dumb.
Impulsive, rather. I want it now. I'm going to do this now. Whatever's in my best interest now or feels right now, I'm going
to
do.
What's even better is that he thinks it's supposed to be some kind of vault disinfectant. Why?
Yeah, that's what he says, right? I guess it smelled like Lysol when he inhaled it. If sci-fi's taught me anything, if you see a weird thing, stick your face in it. If you want to learn about the planet you're on, taste the ground. Mm. Yeah, salt. No, wait, no. That's mummies, I think. No, it's cat litter. That's cat litter, guys. The beings of this planet poop out in the open, guys. I just used science. I tasted the planet. We know everything we need to know about them now.
Oh, man. These guys go deeper, and they find all these hieroglyphics and images of the Yoris, who actually had a third arm coming out of their chest, unlike the two-armed Ahias. Like the Ahias, they were tall and angular with great bellows-like chests, and they were depicted as possessing a supplementary third arm which issued from the bosom, a characteristic which, in vestigial form, sometimes occurs among the Ahis. The ears and nostrils, as far as we could judge, were not so huge and flaring as those of modern Martians.
Important stuff. The thing is, with Mountains of Madness, this is all figuring into a prehistory of humans, you know, the entire human race. Mm-hmm. It's important that, you know, At the Mountains of Madness goes on and on and on and on, but the prehistory stuff is pretty important because it's telling you the origins of the planet that I live on right now. Whereas whether the noses look different between ancient Martians and the... Come on.
Yeah, I kind of find that stuff interesting. To me,
This show's over.
Oh, man.
I gotta go. I'm gonna go keep watching Justice League.
I'm gonna get you back on board because all of these guys are depicted as nude.
What's that?
That's right. All of the aliens have no clothing except for some kind of turban-like thing on their head, which they seem to be pointing at as if focused on it for some unknown reason.
And there's speech balloons that say, "This hurts. It's a monster that lives here." Hmm.
So they keep wandering around and they find the last vault, and there is a mummified Yoris, 7 feet tall, standing erect up against a wall. So he's mummified, desiccated. They notice that it is bolted to the wall and that it has some kind of weird dried up thing on its head, like a hood.
Looks like those drawings. Hmm. Yeah, this really seems more like Alien than the last story. Because, you know, in that they find the alien that it was already done in with evidence of how it happened.
Now, for some stupid reason, Octave touches it and it disintegrates. What was he thinking? Like, what does he think is going to happen? Anyway.
Yeah, he goes, ooh, and he touches it and the whole thing. It fell apart before I could taste or inhale it.
Now, all but the head and torso disintegrate. The hood on the mummy twitches, flops down and lands on Octave's head. He starts screaming and he runs away, dropping his flashlight. The party is so freaked out by this, it takes them a few seconds to run after him.
Yeah, also it's super funny. I mean, it would look funny.
All of my criticism of the story kind of goes away at this point because this is some creepy stuff that's coming up here that really unsettled me because it's very gory as well.
Well, that's what Farnsworth Wright was talking about. He's saying this is great. We got to get to it. You know, we got somebody on the train.
So they run around in the dark trying to find him. They could hear his screams echoing all over the place, but then the screams just stop. Soon after, they begin to hear something clanging, hammering. They follow the noise and they find Octave just standing there. The thing on his head is now blown up to the size of a sofa cushion. That was a weird descriptor.
I mean, but yeah. He looked across the room. Got it. Sofa cushion.
Sofa cushion. His nose and mouth are visible, but the thing is on top of his head, so you can't see anything else but that.
The thing is covering his head like a lampshade. I'm really getting this.
So Octave drops the metal crowbar he was holding, and he begins pushing on the wall. There's a door that opens, and a terrible smell comes rolling out.
Dan, hail it. I think this is incense, guys. These Martians were hippies.
Now, Octave, with this thing on his head, he just stands there and does nothing. Rodney takes out his knife, and he stabs that thing that's all inflated on his head.
An unclean, puffy, leathery thing covered with that fine, mold-like fur of which I have spoken. The knife tore into it as if through rotten parchment, making a long gash, and the horror appeared to collapse like a broken bladder. Out of it, there gushed a sickening torrent of human blood, mingled with dark, filiated masses that may have been half-dissolved hair, and floating gelatinous lumps like molten bone and shreds of a curdy white substance. At the same time, Octave began to stagger, and went down at full length on the floor. Disturbed by his fall, the mummy dust rose about him in a curling cloud, beneath which he lay, mortally still. Conquering my revulsion and choking with the dust, I bent over him and tore the flaccid, oozing horror from his head. It came with unexpected ease, as if I had removed a limp rag, but I wished to God that I had let it remain. Beneath, there was no longer a human cranium, for all had been eaten away. Even to the eyebrows and the half-devoured brain was laid bare as I lifted the cowl-like object. I dropped the unnameable thing from fingers that had grown suddenly nerveless, and it turned over as it fell, revealing on the nether side many rows of pinkish suckers, arranged in circles about a pallid disc that was covered with nerve-like filaments, suggesting a sort of plexus.
That's messed up. That's really gross.
Cowl on the Prowl would have been a good title for this.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's what it is. It's an evil cowl.
One of these guys asks how long he's actually been dead, which is kind of a creepy thought. Like, it just sort of killed him and then he's driving his body around like a go-kart.
Like those possessed ants, right?
Fungus
that makes them do the bidding.
Yeah. Now, before they can discuss it, from out of that open door comes more of these things. Over the broad threshold of the vault, there poured the verminous vanguard of a countless army, things that were kindred to the monstrous diabolic leech I had torn from Octave's eaten head. Some were thin and flat, like writhing and doubling discs of cloth or leather, and others were more or less potty and crawled with glutted slowness. What they had found to feed on in the sealed eternal midnight, I do not know, and I pray that I never shall know.
Ugh.
That is nasty.
It's a little like when you slap a mosquito and it explodes, and that's your blood. If they had brought their trapper keepers, this shit would be no problem, though.
True.
Open it up, lock these suckers up. Click. I'm telling you, while Steve's writing the preface to this in 1988, he's listening to this episode and dying. These references are so topical, he's saying.
So they all run, but in the chaos, they get split up. Rodney hits a dead end. He runs around trying to figure a way out, and he could hear screams in other parts of the tomb. He pulls his knife and he gets moving. On his way out, he sees one of the guys with a thing on his head. He just walks past him into the darkness. You know, doesn't try to grab him, doesn't do anything. Just he's got stuff to do. No flashlight, so these things can see in the dark now. He passes two more of the dudes from his party. They're going the same direction as the other guy. Not his problem anymore. He's just getting out of there.
Yeah.
And just as he nears the exit, things get fuzzy for Rodney at this point, but something drops on his head, blinding me instantly and closing upon me like a tautened net. My brow and scalp at the same time were shot with a million needle-like pangs, a manifold, ever-growing agony that seemed to pierce the very bone and converge from all sides upon my inmost brain.
It's this little furry, flat spot, and it was probably pressed up against a wall, like leaning around the corner waiting for him to walk by, and then, jumped on him. Oh, it's so awesome.
So he thinks at this point he dropped his torch, and then he just stabbed the thing on his head because he had his knife out. When he pierced it, he stabbed himself in the head, you know, because these things aren't tough. So he went right through it and he started, but the pain was so bad from the thing that he didn't even feel the knife going into his own head. He staggers out onto the sands of the ruins, seemingly passes out. The two Martian guides, they find him, they take him back to the camp. Rodney guesses that the things cannot endure sunlight. That's why he was able to be safe for the time being.
The Martian townspeople, by the way, put all his stuff in a lockbox before he went out to Yovambis. We're just going to hold on to this for you. You know, you can have it when you come back. They know what's up.
But even at the camp, there is something, something that the thing put in his mind, and he wants to go back. It's calling to him. It says, "There was a black light, a soundless calling in the vaults of my brain, the implanted summons of the thing, like a permeating and sorcerous poison. It lured me to the subterranean door that was walled up by the dying people of Yovambis to immure those hellish and immortal leeches, those dark parasites that engraft their own abominable life on the half-eaten brains of the dead. It called to me to the depths beyond where dwelt the noisome necromantic ones, of whom the leeches, with all their powers of vampirism and diabolism, are but the merest minions." And then we end with this.
"It was only the two Ihais who prevented me from going back. I struggled. I fought them insanely as they strove to retard me with their spongy arms, but I must have been pretty thoroughly exhausted from all the superhuman adventures of the day. And I went down once more, after a little, into fathomless nothingness, from which I floated out at long intervals to realize that I was being carried across the desert toward Ignar. Well, that is all my story. I have tried to tell it fully and coherently, at a cost that would be unimaginable to the sane. To tell it before the madness falls upon me again, as it will very soon. As it is doing now. Yes, I have told my story, and you have written it all out, haven't you? Now I must go back to Yovambis. Back across the desert and through all the catacombs to the vaster vaults beneath. Something is in my brain that commands me and will direct me. I tell you, I must go."
Wow. You know what I was thinking of just while hearing that was Bugs Bunny. You know how sometimes he would paint a spot on the ground and then be able to jump through the spot, but then the other person couldn't. It was like a little spot you could lift up and throw it on a wall, or maybe that was in Roger Rabbit, but that's what these things look like. It's the little acme spot.
Portable hole.
Portable hole, that's what it is. Yeah, yeah. It just shows you can take a concept and do a funny slapstick or make it horrific.
Yeah, this story, we read the unedited version, and I think Farnsworth probably was right.
Well, he was, but you know what? For the audience of us two, this was the better version to have.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I was glad to be able to read everything, but I agree with you, agreeing with him, that there's a shorter, tighter, train-worthy version of this.
It's powerful. It's really disturbing. And very rarely am I creeped out by a story that we read. And this one creeped me out.
It creeped me out, too. And I think that it's all about that cool monster and the concept of that. And that's why it's better to be simple and straightforward, because unless this is part of it, which I think he may have intended to do, if this was part of something like The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury, bits and pieces of those short stories go into the overall narrative. Even though those stories were published separately, once they were grouped, it shows you the chronology of man's visits on Mars. That said, even he was pretty efficient with that information. It would be told to you by the way that somebody, you know, recalls something that's relevant to the story. Yeah. So the stuff about Martian history, not so great. And it does seem like he's aping at the Mountains of Madness a little.
He might be, like you said, doing a little world building. I haven't read the other stories, so maybe those things tie into those stories to get sort of hooked with that. Like you read about the, oh, I want to know about the Ahias and the Vombis.
Oh, for sure. I think that even that Farnsworth was even a little put off by the sci-fi setting, because typically that was your pulpy adventurer sort of thing. And that's not what we really do at Weird Tales. But I actually, in looking at those letters to Lovecraft, I wasn't really making fun of him, but I do think there's a little hero worship going on there where he might be put, he might not know what his value is, which is making cool monsters.
Yeah.
And some conceptual stuff like that. He thinks, yes, but now I have to drape it in all of these things that I admire in this other artist. And that is so relatable, you know.
Yeah.
For a while, you don't know what you're good at, even if you're doing it, I think. And so you sometimes tend to hide it, anything to mask it, because you're just not sure.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting part of an artist's life when they themselves don't realize why they're, you know, unique and special. It's cool. Yeah. I like it.
Speaking of special, I want to thank our reader, Levi Nunez, for his outstanding reading.
Yeah, thank you, Levi, as always. He's a great musician, and Loot the Body's amazing.
Well, check out his new album, The Barrier Peak Songbook, which is a compilation of older songs and a couple of new numbers, and you're going to love it.
It's great. I love it. Please check it out. I also want to thank some of our patrons, and I want to start by thanking David Lai.
I'd like to thank Grim.
I'd like to thank Kayla Hale.
I'd like to thank Frank Merrick.
Rosie Ann Sheaves, thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy Barber.
Tim Hayes, you're awesome.
Thank you, Thomas Johnson.
Thank you so much, Dustin Rigoli.
And lastly, I'd like to thank Nico MC.
Nico MC, I love you. You are all fantastic, and we're going to be back with more Space Madness this month of April. We haven't picked our next story yet, but I guarantee it's going to have something strange in it, because that's what we do here at Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey at hppodcraft.com, and of course, Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.